I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. When Nicholson Baker gets stone serious about history, I hold my breath. His new book is about a mad lust for bioweapons, germ warfare, at the top of the secret U.S. government in the 1950s, Korean wartime. Nick Baker is obsessive about extracting secret documents in the case, but his book about Project Baseless is only partly documentary. It's equally a sort of writer's diary. What would a deep dive into the secret science of mass killing do to an ordinary man himself? Nick Baker is a novelist and then some, on the model of I.F. Stone or Seymour Hersh. He is relentless in the fine print of public archives. He's got John Updike's musical prose, E.B. White's wry American whimsy, and a lot of Karl Ove Knausgård's eye ever on his own day-to-day doings in the shadow of vast historical nightmares. From his new book, Baseless, here is Nicholson Baker writing as if to a mirror.
We need to know what happened in Washington, D.C. in the 1950s. I can't help believing that if we know what happened, we will do better in the future, and that there's hope. Sometimes I have doubts. Sometimes I have doubts about the whole human experiment. We were too smart and figured out ways to group expendable young men together into armies with swords and shields, and then later with artillery and tanks and airplanes, and now drones. And yet, think of all the greatness of the 20th century. The music, the magazines, the movies. The Russians are coming, for instance, with Alan Arkin. We are, of course, Norwegians. Saul Steinberg, Tracy Chapman, Nabokov, Maeve Brennan, Aretha Franklin. The century of observation and improvisation. And the greatness of the 21st century, too. Rachel Aviv, for instance. Upstairs, I thought, what do I really want from a book? I want truth in every paragraph. I want surprises. I want a sense that everything is not hopeless, that we can do better. I want a sense that life is a complicated mixture of emotions and inconsistencies. Life is a sandwich. I want to include or simulate the pleasure of eating a sandwich.
Nick Baker's new book titled Baseless details almost a decade of his peppering the CIA, the Air Force, the National Archives, under the Freedom of Information Act, trying to tease out 70-year-old policy papers on bio-war. Nick Baker calls it, at the outset, a sort of case history or daily meditation on the pathology of government secrecy.
The journey is the story. At some point, you realize that telling the institutional history of how a gigantic government can make a decision like this to fund a huge program of research into something that sounds really bizarre and fundamentally repellent to most people. How to dream up diseases, make them more contagious, and make them more resistant to antibiotics, for instance. Why would they do that? So that program is itself an interesting thing to study, because why did it happen? Even though many, many thousands and thousands of pages referring to that particular federal program of research have been declassified, there are certain memos and things that are still held back. Not because they hold secrets to how to make a certain weapon or anything like that, but because they are communications between people who might be talking about actually using these things in some theater of war. Those documents were the ones that I was asking for. Please give me these memos that I know exist and that are in the National Archives. I know their exact number, I know the subject heading that they're under, everything about them, but the file that I have just has a yellow piece of cardboard that says access restricted, this file has been removed. So I was just asking for something that I knew was there and that had been slumbering in the files for, you know, 70 years.
Are they saving themselves from embarrassment or trying to keep a threat alive?
Oh, I don't think they're trying to keep a threat alive. I think that the government is almost always sheltering itself from embarrassment. I think that that's the main energy. The reason why secrets are kept so vigilantly, so hermetically, when they're very, very old, say 50, 60, 70 years old, is because if those secrets are kept, then that kind of shock of knowledge can't happen. And then, therefore, the agencies that are still doing things are not imperiled by the fact that they look insane. If you declassify these things, the things that they were doing are very, very objectionable. And everybody would agree that they were objectionable.
You write, Nick, that by the mid-1950s, the weapons research in which the CIA took an interest included work on fleas doped with plague, mosquitoes doped with yellow fever, voles dripping with plague, and crop-killing funguses of wheat. You quote Frank Wisner, one of the real bad guys in your book, chief of the CIA's action arm, writing in a memo that he needed to use the latest science and technology to modernize, as he put it, clandestine, unconventional warfare of the following six types. But then the next six lines are blacked out. You're sure that germ warfare was on that list. Why?
Well, I'm not sure about anything. Wisner in the memo says that we must keep up. The CIA is asked to do these things, and we must be up with the latest trends and techniques in biological, chemical, and radiological warfare. So we know that he's interested in that stuff. His code name during World War II was Typhoid, and he named all of his Confederates by diseases. He was a guy who was fascinated by diseases, and he had, in fact, a very serious bout of disease at one point in the 50s that he had slowly recovered from. But what I think is revealing why you would want to see what's actually on that memo is to see what particular interventions and tricks and stratagems he was considering doing right at the very opening moments of the newly radicalized CIA. This is not the CIA of professorial people writing white papers about the economic conditions in Guatemala or something. This is the new CIA under George Kennan that is going to get down with the planet and really do things, really dig into places, really do the unsettling, impermissible things that would destabilize and change regimes around the world. And in order to do that, he felt, Wisner felt, this poor man who is a manic depressive and really a tragic figure,
ended up shooting himself with his son's shotgun.
Right. I mean, he's not a happy person, but he sort of, what did he think was a good idea at that point? That's what we need to know. Because we're really living now with the consequences of many of those interventions and pokings in governments all around the world. And so we've got to figure out what is on the pages. But there's a lot of stuff there, but it's not able to be included in what historians write about because there are just these enormous white patches on a page, or it'll just say the next 15 pages are denied.
The interest, the stockpiles are pretty clear. The use is still a question. What do you conclude, Nick Baker? And on what mix of intuition, evidence, judgment?
The conclusion about whether or not some sort of actual disease weapon was used in a war zone. Is that the...
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there were two phases. The first phase was a very small, very sneaky program in which, as the Americans retreated from the north of Korea when the Chinese counterattacked late in 1950, in November of 1950, they left behind diseases. That's what the Chinese charged, and I think that charge is, in fact, unfortunately, accurate. What happened was that after this amazing retreat of American forces all the way down to the extreme bottom tip of Korea, several months later, a brand new disease began infecting American soldiers in Korea. They began dying of this extremely, it was a very high fever and involved the bleeding from various organs, and it was just a terrifying, ferocious disease that hit, and it hit on several different places or foci along what is now essentially the DMZ. So it was a belt of infection, and that's what the American epidemiologists called it. And they were puzzled by it. Why did this happen? There's no route for how the disease got there. Just this particular little, very specific foci of infection. So there's a charge by the Chinese. There's a report of a mysterious group of Americans flinging feathers around in hazmat suits. And then there's a disease that appeared. So I think that has a very high likelihood of being true. A very tiny program, but it has left a lasting legacy of disease in Korea because people still get sick with Korean hemorrhagic fever.
Does it trouble you, Nick Baker, that in a review in the New York Times, a writer named Kevin Baker, no relation, says you haven't got the evidence and it's not helpful to be spreading the suspicion? And I also wonder if you connect that with the anointed Abe Rosenthal writing in 1952 in the New York Times that these charges were unfounded from the North Korean and the Chinese governments.
Well, I think it's important to have people say, make the best case you can. And I don't think there's ever going to be some memo that says explicitly, we want you to take these boxes of feathers and they have a bunch of diseases that our Japanese colleagues have put in them. And we want you to do that. That's never going to appear. In this effort to tell the truth about what happened, there's always going to be some uncertainty. What I'm saying is that we need the documents that actually exist now that would say things like, from one person to another, let's investigate what other options we have in Korea when we go to Camp Dietrich and talk to so-and-so about this or that disease. That kind of document would be helpful because we know that there was some talk of the possibility of using it in Korea. So I'm not troubled when people say that there is no absolute conclusive proof because that's not what's going to happen. What is going to happen is that gradually, I hope, more and more pieces of the past, fragments of this mosaic, will come out.
Nicholson Baker is our guest on Writing Baseless. Coming up, all the things we are, a moody historian's ups and downs on the meanings of America. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Nicholson Baker, in his new book, Baseless, is recounting the zeal in the young CIA after World War II to develop secret, new tech, unconventional war capacity. Let's remember, it wasn't just Korea. You write, and you flatter us, I think, Nick Baker, that if regular people knew the CIA was burning sugarcane in the fields of Cuba, developing virulent strains of anthrax resistant to any combination of drugs, designing these feather bombs, literally bird feathers, dusted with hog cholera and crop diseases, we the people would have stopped it. I hope you're right.
I think I am right. I think that this is, there was a kind of a nice moment of confirmation from Joseph Pulitzer, the editor of the New York World. At one point, I was in the audience of a movie that I'd been interviewed in, and Pulitzer is quoted in the movie as saying, there isn't any crime that cannot be approached and neutralized by its disclosure. Get secrets out in the open, let people look at them, and the indignant, I don't think this is, I'm paraphrasing terribly, but the outrage will wash them away, will make it better. I do believe that. I think most people are genuinely horrified to hear some of the stuff that was going on in the Pentagon, and my job is to lay it out. There are a lot of studies of, you know, the Cold War, and there's a sort of marbleized aspect to these things. But what is this stuff actually? It's scientists making a living, injecting animals, large and small, monkeys and mice and everything, with all kinds of bizarre germs, and passing those germs as they euthanize that creature, grinding up their internal organs, then passing that intensified infection through another set of creatures and another, until they finally get an infection that is worse for human beings than it was at the beginning. And that's what they were doing over and over again, was making bad diseases worse. And I just don't think that most people believe that that is one of the aims of the medical profession or the scientific biological profession. I think that people would be shocked by it.
Nick, in your writer's diary slice of this book, you insert all sorts of wonderfully tender phrases that just come to you as you're coming down the stairs or something. The gorgeousness of everything one morning, the gorgeous, precarious fabric of consciousness, the foolishly squandered but endlessly lavish preciousness of any life. Again, who are you writing that for?
I think for myself, partly, because I think that one of the things one studies, if you're working on a book about just really objectionable things, is what kind of fatigue does that involve? Does it wear you down? Do you reach a point of actual despair? And I found that I would sort of have to talk myself into remembering that life is not about weird Cold War science. It's not about that at all. It's about other things. I'm studying weird Cold War science because we're dealing with the aftershocks of it, and I think it's worth knowing more about. But if you study something as a historian, any depressing subject, if you go too deeply into it, it becomes paralyzing. The battle is, how do you stay on an even keel, or even how do you stay cheerful? How do I continue to be a good husband and a reasonable person to the person, the cashier at the supermarket, and do all the things that human beings have to do, and also be kind of swimming in all these half declassified, frustratingly, imperfectly declassified documents about things that shouldn't have happened?
In your book, Nick, there is outrage and heartbreak, even a few laugh lines in your own listing of the best and worst of our country. One passage in particular covers the promise and the horror, starting on page 331. Would you read it?
Sometimes I don't believe in the history of the United States. I don't believe that this place deserves to have any sort of moral standing in the world as a country. It has been the source of incalculable disruption. I understand that Americans individually have done good things. Paintings, sitcoms, songs, cars, toasters, locomotives, buildings, bridges, billboards, sunglasses, topiary, dance steps, casseroles, no-hitters, corn mazes, speeches, ad campaigns, YouTube videos. The New Yorker of the Catherine White and E.B. White era is a great American achievement, no question. I always go back to the mid-century New Yorker. And there's John Singer Sargent. But Operation Sphinx, this homegrown American plan to kill 5 million human beings in the space of weeks, almost all of them civilians, is just too awful to think about.
You're referring to our friend Gene Gilliman's book on Operation Sphinx.
Yes. I think that's another thing that you need to be able to do as a historian, is allow moods in to a work, a long work. And I've always was dissatisfied reading a real history, let's say history by people who spend their lives writing history, is that it's all the same mood. If they're Gibbon, it's always this kind of witty, fluid prose style, and it, maybe some days were bad days for him and some days were good days. You know, there were moments of despair, and I want to know that, I guess. So that was a day in which I had reached a low point, in which I had thought, I just can't believe that this country, this great country that I love so much, could possibly have been involved in this plan to kill or injure 10 million people in Japan using all these horrific gases right at the end of World War II. I didn't know that was a thing. I now know it. It's one of those facts that when you know it, cuts at you. It hurts. So that moment in the book is a moment of despair, and I'm trying to pivot out of it by listing off for myself the things that I genuinely believe, although it's a little bit of a funny list, but I genuinely believe that these things are more characteristically, truly great about the United States. Car ads and topiary and the mid-century New Yorker and pop songs and humor and comedy.
Jerome Kern.
All of that stuff is the greatness and the originality, the shocking, massive brilliance of the United States are in all of those miscellaneous areas of human activity. All of that is part of what's great about the country. What's not great about the country is usually involved with the State Department and the presidential administrations because they're all doing a very crude sort of foreign policy that is really schoolboyish. It's just a bunch of overeducated people messing and struggling with ways to trip up other countries.
Nick, I love an sort of aside you write about historians, including historians like yourself. You say, amnesia is the CIA's ideal. Historians are professional rememberers. They find ways through the thickets of specificity. They connect one name with another. They load a lot into their heads, more and more of it, until they feel themselves brimming over with too much. And then they put it all down in a book, which is an album of smoothed and aligned and combed through memories. Really, secrecy is about mind control. It's about deliberately imposed historical amnesia. If you can suppress all knowledge of something like Operation Sphinx for decades, you allow the myth of American decency and goodness to endure. By the time the truth comes out, the shock is muffled. The outrage response is inhibited.
When secrets are kept for not one or two or three decades, but for five, six, seven decades, the secret itself, because it's not allowed to seep out into public discourse, we don't adjust to it. We don't learn from it, but we tell the narratives of the past without that particular thing being part of it.
Nick, I've read, I think, almost all of your many books. My favorite is Human Smoke, and I'm still amazed that you got away with it. Mainly because it turned Winston Churchill, the great orator and captain of the team in a way, into a very, very bad imperialist, compulsive hater, as so many people said. Your book read like a sort of giant wall of post-it notes, featuring people like Mahatma Gandhi, Dorothy Day, people of all religions and stripes who foresaw the incredible killing and destruction of that war. Not only that, but the emphasis on exemplary war, war to teach people a lesson, the strategic starvation, indiscriminate abuse of civilians. In Iraq in the 1920s, I never read it except in your book, Churchill had written, "I'm strongly in favor of using poisoned gas against uncivilized tribes, and first of all, to scare them." Through World War II, he was always determined that England would hold on to India forever. So that's the other side, and people heard it for the first time. I still can't get those views out of my mind. So I thank you for that. And this book is out of that pattern, I think, right?
It's first of all a project of self-education, because I was not a history major in college, and I think everybody needs to figure these things out. Why was the Second World War fought the way it was fought, a long war of attrition, as Churchill called it? What did that do to the civilians who were trapped and at risk in the places where the war was being fought? What happened? What actually happened? And was there another way? Would a negotiated earlier end to the war have actually saved many lives, perhaps millions of lives? So those are questions that I wanted to find out for myself in working through the documentary history of the war. In this case, I wanted to know what happened about the period that's very influenced by World War II, because all the people who are running these secret programs and these Air Force bombing missions in Korea were all people who had, most of them were veterans of World War II. They were highly decorated veterans who then got Pentagon jobs or were sent to command the 5th Air Force in the Far East. So that's, this book is in a sense a strange inside-out sequel to Human Smoke. It's saying, okay, we had that convulsion and cataclysm and told chronologically, but now in the 50s, there's so much deliberate covert action. There's so many secrets floating around that in some ways the actual solvent medium of what the historian has to live in is different. It's sort of like ethylene glycol versus the World War II is, you know, something closer to water and blood. I mean, the Cold War is just a very confusing time still, because so much of it is unchronicled and unknown. So it has to be, the form of the book has to be different.
In this book about the 50s, the Cold War stands in as the source, as the origin story, and it makes everything seem rational. I couldn't get over the grip of that tension with the Russians as the driving force in every political mind, not everyone, but certainly the higher end of government. It's all Cold War thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked all over the world. Did not come to Armageddon, but what a waste.
One of the things I chronicle in the book is that the Library of Congress was hired by the Air Force secretly, and I'm the first person to really tell this story, to find bomb targets in Soviet bloc countries. So there was a whole floor and then two floors of people who were paid by the Air Force and by the CIA to do this secret work. And there were guards in the doors, and there was classified document disposal programs, and it was all hidden in tiny footnotes in the annual report or not mentioned at all. But what happened was when the Korean War started, this origin moment that you mentioned, when the actual Korean War started and the Cold War became in this one place incredibly hot and deadly, that was the moment that the Library of Congress, which had been thinking of telling the Air Force, we don't want to do this anymore. We need to hold on to all of our stuff. We need the floors that are filled with bomb targets. We need the bomb targeteers. We need to use those square footages to hold all the books and newspapers and magazines that we have. That's what the building was built to hold. As soon as the Korean War started, that program of rejecting the Air Force flipped around, and the Librarian of Congress said, we have figured out a way to solve this, and we are very proud to be serving the Air Force during this difficult time. And then he went with his team of top administrators to these places and figured out how to dispose pulp, weed, and basically clean out areas of the library's collections. Basically, beautiful things were gotten rid of starting at that time in order to make room, physical room, for the Cold War.
And the documents that trickled out or got ferreted out are just hair-raising. You got a printout from the Strategic Air Command in Curtis LeMay time that listed 1,200 cities in the old Soviet bloc that were marked for, their words, systematic destruction. Bucharest, Budapest, Dresden, East Berlin, Hanoi, Harbin, Nanking, Prague, Pyongyang, Riga, Shanghai, each city with a priority and a certain number of designated ground zeros where individual atomic bombs would land. I mean, there's the Cold War in a long sentence.
Right, and that was a thing I didn't know about. That's a man I interviewed, as because of the book is filled with interviews of people I think of as the good guys here, of the people who are trying to get the information out of the government. A man named William Burr, who works at the National Security Archive, had a success, and he got this enormous listing of all the targets all over the world as part of one of the government's nuclear war plans. And it is an astonishing list. It's such a huge list. And the idea that there were something like 13 designated ground zeros in Beijing and cities all over China, that when we're talking about a war with Russia, we need to actually enrich the notion of what that meant at the time. It meant a war with a large part of the entire world, because there was such a feeling that Russia was just the marionette master, puppet master, and all these other places were just doing Russia's bidding. It's astonishing. And the thing was that the National Security Archive, after much struggle, got this document and they publish it. And that is the work that has to continue to be done. But it has to happen much, much more quickly, because most of what William Burr and his colleagues do at the National Archive is petition for and plead and ask and basically try without much success to get documents, and then occasionally they have a lawsuit that's successful. It's got to be much quicker, because the longer that you wait to learn what actually happened, when 50 years become 60 and 70 and 80, the particular thing that you're talking about becomes so lost. It's gone from modern memory. It's gone from the memory of the people who were alive at the time.
Coming up, history found and told in fragments. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source with the Omni writer, Nicholson Baker. Nick, I want to come back to this book, Baseless, as a literary project by one of our most original, versatile, interesting, big-time authors. What is it doing to you, Nick, the inner man, the citizen, the guy who chose a kind of, not exile, but a sort of remote, happy old barn in Maine to do your work in?
What I feel about this book now is just an immense sense of relief, because while I wrote four other books, I was on and off engaged in the research that led to this book. And so these questions have been kind of tugging at me, worrying me. I've been talking to my wife about crop diseases and anti-plant warfare and strange weapons and insects in the snow and stuff for 10 years. And I am so glad that I have finally, at least, I've gotten some of the story out into something. It's a book is so blocky, and I don't know. It's just this compact compartment that holds things that when you read it, it's not possible to know how much was involved in that particular paragraph, how many sources had to be consulted or whatever, or was this a paragraph that I just rattled off, or was this a paragraph that involved several different pieces of research from several different years? It's not possible to know that. I don't even remember it. I look at it with a kind of amazement and just, I guess, a bliss. Now I am able to start not forgetting, but cleaning out some of the RAM, the random access memory in my mind, and and replacing it with other things that are worth thinking about. The privilege of being able to forget is one of the blessings of having finished.
There's another aspect of this as a literary project that fascinates me, as it did in Human Smoke. I call it fragments as a literary device, jottings, a phrase from a letter, somebody's diary, or last words, giving up the ghost, or whatever. And you do it incredibly well. There's a passage, barely a paragraph, about the late Henry Cabot Lodge, senator from the Massachusetts, defeated by John Kennedy in 1952. Kennedy appointed him ambassador to Vietnam. He was a horror show. He wrote urgently, "We've got to step up this war. This is Kennedy time. I want to hear screams coming out of North Vietnam. Intensify that bombing." One telegram of Henry Cabot Lodge's made four uses of the word scream. Sadistic. About people that never heard a flea in this country. Speak about Henry Cabot Lodge. And I've got a list of others I want your quick takes on.
I was fascinated by him, and it just happened that the Massachusetts Historical Society has his papers, and they're rich. And I went through, and I got to know him. And that's the great excitement of doing a book of history is that you don't know what you're going to find. You sometimes you go to a place, a collection of papers, and there's very little. Sometimes there's totally unexpected moments and surprises. And in this case, though, the screams that he was talking about exist in a published document now. It's published as part of one of the State Department's foreign relations of the United States. It's just there on the page, and you realize that it was a kind of sadistic petulance was a combination. And he was a difficult man, a very difficult man.
Speaking of Harry Truman, he was well known for, after the Bay of Pigs, saying that CIA was out of control, doing a kind of job in active military adventures that it was not designed for, should be broken up. But you say there was another Harry Truman.
Unquestionably. Harry Truman was a very secretive man, and he was the person who authorized and continued to authorize the atomic bombing. That's not a secret, but it's maybe less known that he was fully aware that the Japanese wanted to surrender before he continued with the bomb program. He was a man who, I think he was, sometimes could be funny, and he had a strong sense of duty, but he also had just a real streak of paranoia, and his obsession was with the communist conspiracy. And he used that phrase over and over, the communist conspiracy, which had penetrated the United States. And so he put the people who were in charge of the American Communist Party in jail. And he closed down periodicals, and he took people's passports away out of this fear that, the communist infection was going to spread to the United States. And he also then hugely increased funding for biological weapons, chemical weapons, and he was a bigot. He was a terrible, deeply unpleasant, bigoted person. I'm sorry to have to say this because I loved reading David McCullough's biography of Truman. But the McCullough biography, although it's an astonishing work of history, is also something of a deception because the man was not a noble person or a person of the people doing his best and muddling through. And no, he was really sneaky, actually, and not truthful. I'm sorry.
Speak of George Kennan, famous author of the X article inaugurating the Cold War.
Brilliant, very talented writer, also with a streak of paranoia. After the Italian elections were corrupted by the Americans in 1948, he thought, how do we do this on a more formal basis? And he came up with the idea that there would be an Office of Special Projects that would be guided by the State Department, but would be managed by the Central Intelligence Agency. And he hired Frank Wisner to run that department. And then it just grew and ballooned. But Kennan himself is an interesting person because he had, at periods, enough intelligence to understand that other regimes, other countries are, you know, guided not by automaton warriors of world ambition, but of just of people. And so he understood and tried to write sometimes things that would restrain the government from some of its darkest documents of anti-Soviet action. But other times, it got to him too. The State Department was a deeply screwed up place. The State Department, the CIA, and the Truman White House were all populated by people who were just filled with fears and suspicions. And he was carried away by that. And so much so that he then left and sort of assumed a professorial life.
One more fragment, one more name. Vannevar Bush. A lot of people will have forgotten him. No connection to the Connecticut Bushes, but president of MIT, a brilliant scientist, a much more powerful man than I ever realized.
Well, Vannevar Bush was absolutely in charge of the nuclear weapons program during World War II. But he's also thought of as kind of a prophet of information science because he...
The
internet, yeah, all that stuff. And that's fine. But what is so fascinating about him is that he was the instigator under Roosevelt. He was Roosevelt's science confidant, instigator of the secret biological weapons program during World War II. He started that off. Then you would think that after the war was over that he would want that decommissioned. But no, he was again in charge of the Research and Development Board, and these papers would come out under his guidance in which the idea was to hire more germ scientists and get more diseases, including things like so-called warthog disease, which is now the disease of pigs that the world is dealing with. I mean, the diseases and potato bug pathogens and all sorts of stuff that is really not things that we should have been tinkering with. They came from the brilliant and addled mind of Vannevar Bush. He was the godfather of germ warfare, which is just intolerable and wrong. MIT keeps popping up in my research. For some reason, these people who were big names at MIT would then, like the president of MIT, would go over to interview Japanese germ warriors and find out whether or not they'd told all the story or whether they might, were they holding something back, you know?
Have a few bugs back, so to speak.
Yeah.
Nick Baker, we read your book in a very distinct era of our lives, this COVID pause, tremendous anxiety, but also reflection. I'm beginning to call it a sort of age of awakening. And there are a lot of these stories that fit. The rediscovery in this interim, thanks to Black Lives Matter and other events, of slavery by another name that persists in so many different bad forms in our life. Speak of this moment. It's a very strange time. But what are you learning? What are you hoping for? What's your worst fear?
We're locked down. So we're forced back to first principles. What is a life all about? What are we going to accomplish? What do we want to get done? How do we make an effort to be better people? And maybe it forces a kind of get real feeling. I mean, I feel it. It's just, what do we want from a government? Do we want to tolerate things that have been so obviously wrong for so many decades? No, we don't. We don't want that to happen anymore. That's not going to happen anymore. That's not acceptable. That fundamental feeling that it's time. It's now time to actually act, and we know the truth. And so that pressure, that excitement of conviction can move outward into other areas. And I think one of the things that crosses over into all sorts of specific grievances is secrecy, that there are specific actions and decisions and meetings by presidents and suppressions of dissent that have happened all through the 20th century that we don't have the full specifics on. So declassifying documents may sound like a kind of academic exercise, but it's actually part of this feeling of how does a country introspect? How do we understand ourselves? In order to look back, you actually have to have a memory. You actually have a functioning things to look back on. And as far as the political history of the country, that those things that you look back on reside often on pieces of paper. And those pieces of paper need to be respected and declassified completely, and I hope scanned and made available to everybody so that they can nourish this flowering of genuine self-understanding that we're going through.
Two other points, though, I want to ask you about fodder for this, what could be, I think, a great age of awakening. One, prompted by Jamel Bowie in the New York Times last week. He was talking about these troops landing in Portland, maybe next week in Chicago, even New York, unmarked military guys, heavily armed. And he was saying, this is the empire come home. We are now beginning to see our own cities the way foreign cities see us. This is naked force, unauthorized, uninvited, unwelcome, but they're there. What do we make of that kernel of instant understanding of what's happening? Anybody, any child can see what's happening.
It is. It's the world of paramilitary warfare that was happening for decades all over the world. The same teams are now wandering around Portland and other places, and we can learn from that.
Can we fight it?
Yeah, and that's just an incredibly powerful moment that it's actually so new that I don't think that we can talk about it yet. It's just happening. It's like being on the street with the chaos of tear gas and all those, by the way, all of those chemicals were all developed as ways of controlling leftist movements in places like Vietnam and Korea and places like that.
Last item on my list, Nick. Gary Hart, sometime senator from Colorado, George McGovern's campaign manager in 1972, thoughtful guy, had an op-ed in the Times in which he said he and Walter Mondale were the last surviving members of the Frank Church committee that investigated the CIA back in the, what, 80s?
70s, yeah, the Church Committee, yeah.
His point was that President Trump is asserting powers that nobody knows about. I'm authorized to do things that nobody else know about. And Gary Hart said, what are you talking about? We know the Constitution. We can research Congress's legislation. Let's find out what he's talking about. And yet I haven't heard anybody take it up yet. Like, of course, ask him. Who does he think he is?
I don't know. I think we're, as a country, somewhat just stunned the way you would be stunned if some sort of lawnmower kind of started chewing through your garden and there's a moment of total bewilderment. We're seeing things happen so quickly and decisions being made and justified by things that are completely false so quickly that the normal mechanisms of dissent aren't keeping up.
Say there is a way somehow. I mean, it has everything to do with waking up, but say there's a way.
I just have to think that it begins in the streets and moves floor by floor into quieter rooms where people are working on policy and thinking about things. That sometimes taking to the streets is the first step of something that ends up being a whole revolution of intellectual outlook. So I think we're on the verge of something good, that certain fossilized horrors will crumble and fall away. I hope I'm right. I mean, it could be that it will all reform itself and go back to normalcy, the old normalcy. But maybe it's a moment the way it was just after the Vietnam War. There was this moment, which I grew up in, where the world really felt as if it was changing. The whole Earth catalog and things like that that now seem very quaint were part of a feeling that human gentleness and fair dealing and informality were all taking over these institutions that had been top-hatted and cravatted and over-rigidified and supported with tanks and ammunition, that things were softening. Maybe that's happening. I mean, softening with some tear gas and explosions along the way.
I want to agree with you that something very, very promising is trying to develop out there. Deeply mysterious, but we got to encourage it. Nick Baker, it's such a pleasure always to talk with you because you can talk about anything and bring a kind of civilized, deeply read, deeply thought freshness to the whole conversation.
Well, gosh, thank you, Chris. I always enjoy talking to you. And I always think I understand myself a little better after I've talked with you.
Well, I feel the same way about you and me after talking to you, listening to you. Nick Baker, thank you.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Support Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll also find a growing audio library, including Adam Coleman's ongoing series of interviews about reading in a time of social distance. This week, he talks with the biographer Claire Carlisle about the great ponderer of solitude, Soren Kierkegaard. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman.
Mary McGrath keeps all of our secrets. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.